Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore.
A statist in the most true sense. You know, I was a Marine. I was an aspiring law enforcer. That was the route I was going in life. Something happened where I got mixed up in the judicial system. And it was really eye-opening about how the system works once you are actually subjected to it. And that sense just kind of built up in me. And I started reading into philosophy and all of that. And I began to see that, you know, these arguments in favor of the state are usually just rhetorical. There's no real substance to them. So I started thinking to myself, you know, how can you tell people, how can you communicate that message to people in a way that they can respond, you know, in a positive manner to it? And so I started constructing these arguments in my head, and I thought, well, why don't I put these down on paper, you know, instead of posting taxation is theft on every post on Facebook, you know, I can do something with a little bit more substance. And I loved researching different things and then telling people what I found from my research, because people usually respond pretty well to solid facts and not just, you know, hearsay. So a big portion of the book is, you know, you'll find 20 references in one chapter, you know, it's backed. Everything I say is backed by something that you can immediately go and fact check for yourself. And people, I think, respond really positively to that sort of argument. And that's really the foundation of the book.
Right. Yeah, it's really interesting. So, you know, I've kind of tried to do a lot of the same thing. And of course, I still like posting taxation is theft on everything. But
of course.
But yeah, it's really interesting because you see, like, when you get into these discussions with people, you really get to see, like, what's their response and what's their thought process. And you really do find out that a lot of people are just, they've got like these pre-programmed responses that don't make any sense. It's just like they're regurgitating politician propaganda that they've heard on the TV for so long. So it's really interesting to see this kind of stuff. And you really went into, like, analytically, like, you know, looking at these as far as what is the foundation of a solid argument? So it's like, when you read this, it's not just like, here's why you should believe what I believe. It's actually like you construct, like, really interesting arguments for, you know, setting up a premise and then putting together the pieces to kind of construct this picture using kind of a method that's like, it can't be disputed. It's like the argument is sound. It's both argumentally correct and the facts going into it are correct. And that's kind of like, you know, where you can't break it down. So it's really interesting to see that. And it's also interesting to hear, like, you know, this was kind of the example for me, and I know so many other people, right? It's like when you think the government's all fine until you end up on the wrong end of the police badge, and, you know, they do whatever, whether it's, you know, they're stealing money from you or sticking you in jail for something. It's really interesting to see so many people that really makes them flip, but it's, all this good comes out of it, that we start really researching into this. So, let's talk about some of these issues that you have, that you talk about in the book. So one of them is we need the state because there are bad people. What's kind of your main, I guess, what's your main argument for that?
Well, I would say the main argument against that is really the fact that it's a fallacious argument. So what I mean by that is your premise is can really be used against you. You know, you're saying there's bad people, therefore we need this state. But really, the more logical, the more sound argument would be, well, yeah, I agree there's bad people, but that's exactly why we shouldn't have this apparatus where they can, these bad people have the potential to assume basically complete control over your lives and over the lives of millions of other people, over, you know, armies and nuclear weapons. You know, that's, to me, that's a much more sound argument to say that, look, yeah, there, I agree there's bad people, you know, and that way you're kind of meeting them halfway on their argument. You're like, okay, well, yes, I agree with you, there is bad people, but look, at, you could use that same rationale to support the opposing argument, and really it makes much more sense when you do that.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting, and like I'm you know, there's so many examples where the government tries to you know, it tries to solve a problem where there's bad people, and then it ends up creating an even worse problem. You know, whether it's the police, where it's like, okay, yeah, there are bad people, and then you end up with, okay, well, those bad people now have jobs on the police force, so they're supposed to be protecting us, but now you know, they have that power, they're still bad people, and they never face any consequences. So yeah, it's, you know, it's just like that. You're creating power of authority, and ultimately, as that grows, you're going to need more people in that position, and that's going to be open to the people who want to do bad things. Hey, I want to go commit crime. I can either pick up a gun and do it, or I can go join the government and do it there, and I can do so much worse.
Right, and it all depends too on, you know, how you define what is a bad person. I think a bad person is somebody who, you know, aggressively violates the consent of another individual, but that is what the state does. And so if that's how you define what a bad person is, well, it's completely an invalid argument to say that the state needs to be there to protect you from the bad people, because if that's how you define a bad person, which most people do, they define it, you know, that's how they define what a bad person is, when you violate the consent of another. But that's what the state is. So
right,
you have to really examine what it is to be a bad person.
So this is interesting, because I just saw, have you heard about the car accident with, what's his name? I'm blanking on names. Kevin Hart and someone else who was driving, and they had like, it was like an old car from the 70s, and they restored it, and they ended up racing or something and driving it off the road. And now California wants to come up with a new law that requires anyone who restores the old cars to put in like these 5-point racing harnesses. So, you know, now they have like, you know, any car manufactured has to have a seatbelt on it and airbags and everything else. But now they want to kind of create and enforce rules on how the older restored cars are going to have, you know, what kind of equipment they're going to have. So I thought that was pretty interesting, because for one thing, that's at the state level. So you're going to see a lot of people going out of the state to fix that. But I see a lot of people coming up, you know, it's a really interesting debate, because on one side you have people that are saying, no, you know, we should have the right to decide for ourselves what kind of safety equipment we want to put in these cars that we're restoring. And then you have the other people who are saying, well, but if it weren't for the government, we wouldn't even have seatbelts and airbags and everything else. So it's an interesting thing that happens when you get, you know, some event happens, and then everybody, you know, never let a good tragedy go to waste. Everybody comes out and tries to use this to justify one way or the other. What do you think on, you know, what do you think about that sort of statist opinion that, you know, why would car companies invest and make sure that every single one of their cars has a seatbelt or an airbag if there's no law forcing them to do that?
Right. I get into something like that kind of in my arguments for corporations, kind of in the middle of the book, where, you know, we list examples of all these things companies are doing nowadays, all the perks that they're giving their employees, all the benefits, you know, treating their employees very lavishly. And you could ask yourself, well, why would they do that if they're not being forced to? And it's like, well, there's reasons why they do that. And it's because, one, it positively affects their bottom line. And two, it's because you know, not all people are monsters. That's just right. The reality of it too. Now, if you're going to assume that all people are bad, that's, you know, okay, fine. You can assume that, but at the same time, it's just as logical to assume all people are good, or you could cut in the middle and assume, well, there's some good people, some bad people. And, you know, this idea that nobody will ever do a good thing unless the state forces them to, it's beyond reason. There's no evidence for that. We have evidence against it every single day of our lives. And again, furthermore, it's really in their bottom line. People want safe cars. There's a reason why car companies advertise a 5-star safety rating. It's because it helps them sell vehicles, and a seatbelt is part of that. Once you accept the idea that you can force people just through blind aggression to, you know, direct society that way, things just really stop making sense. You know, seatbelt laws, all those types of laws that are supposed to protect us against ourselves, it just stops making sense, because a politician will just do something to sign his name to a bill so that he can get reelected, you know, right, come the next year. None of it makes any sense anymore. It's hard to even address
for me.
Those. Right, exactly. Yeah. And it becomes very hard to even address those arguments without, you know, deconstructing it back down to the very first principles of how we get a free market society with that's safe and, you know, profitable for everyone. You really have to, those surface arguments that often are presented to you, it's hard to just address that sort of argument. You have to break it way down and say, hey, look, that's just not the way things are. And so I try to do that in my book in the best way possible, and in a way that doesn't bore the reader to death, you know.
Right. So what would you say? What would you say a society without a government looks like?
It's always a tough question, because it can look like so many different things. Because, you know, in the anarchist ideal, they don't believe in a system where, you know, the anarchist is designing
right.
The society in which they live. You know, it's a good way, I think, to explain it is, if you believe in an ideal of democracy in which there's this will of the people, and the will of the people is the best way to structure society, which most people in the Western world, that's the way they think. Well, now even in the Eastern world, you see what's happening in Hong Kong. It's people want this democratic idea where the will of the people is the priority. And if that's the way you're thinking, what better way to do it than to let every individual direct their lives as they see fit? I mean, if that's not right. The will of the people, I don't know what is. So that's kind of an argument that is
right.
Really effective in a world where most people value this will of the people notion. So
that's actually really interesting, because if, like, when you get into a discussion with a statist who says, you know, so what are you going to have, total anarchy? You know, it's kind of like it is. I mean, you look at different cities, right? And cities are already, they're so different, because there are different people living there, and they come up with different ways to solve different problems, right? Some cities come up with, you know, even though it's central planning, they come up with subway systems. Some come up with electric bike rentals, you know, different ways to get around town. Some of them have smart car rentals, all that kind of stuff. There's all kinds of different ways. But when you have someone who's saying, you know, well, we have to have police, we have to have this, we have to have that, what they're really saying is, screw democracy, I just want it my way. Like, that's my way to plan the city. If I were to plan a perfect city, it would have this. It would have everybody pays taxes, everybody has police, everybody has this and this and this. And they're not considering whether or not they have the majority vote, because of course we don't get to vote on that stuff, right? We get to vote on which politicians get to decide on what to do, but we don't get to directly vote on that. So it could be very well that, you know, if given the choice, would most people in a city vote to downsize their police force versus adding more officers, if they had a direct vote rather than, you know, voting for a mayor or a city board. So that's really interesting to consider that that statist argument is, this is how I would plan the city, but I'm going to kind of hide behind the fact that somebody else is doing it, so you can't blame me for it. I'm not forcing my will on you. It's just somebody else, and that's just the way it works. It's like they're kind of deflecting that that they've done that. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's an attempt to actually gain more freedom than the rest of us. So I wrote an article recently, kind of explaining what you're talking about, how, you know, it's the statist, the one who wants to constantly use the force of the government to exercise his will. They're really seeking more freedom than the anarchist is. The anarchist wants to live according to a standard of, you know, respecting the consent of others and most likely, a private property ethic. But it's the statist who wants to exceed past that amount of freedom and actually be able to exercise his will freely by imposing it on others. And it's kind of a paradox, because it's like they're seemingly arguing for less freedom, but at the same time, what they really want is the freedom to exercise their will without restraint, and they want to use the government to do that. So it's an interesting kind of paradox that plays out. The anarchist actually, in a certain way, wants more limited freedom, but it's a rational freedom. You know, it's free to exercise my will so long as it doesn't impose. Exactly.
And that's like what the statist is doing. Like, I want to be free to impose my will on you without your consent. I want to be able to take your money and use it for these things.
While at the same time wanting their own consent respected by everybody else. So it's really an interesting dynamic playing out in their minds.
Yeah, that is quite paradoxical. Yeah. Wow. it's kind of funny, because a statist will say, like, what? So you want people just running around doing whatever they want, stealing from people? Well, yeah, that's kind of what you're advocating for, stealing from me to pay for your police force, who's going to run around doing whatever you want them to do.
Right, exactly.
Wow, that's really interesting. So what else? I know you talked a lot about building roads, and that's something... That's something I used to take offense to, that question, or not offense, but it would just frustrate me. Like, shut up, man, you're not listening. Who cares about the roads? But once I started kind of listening and understanding the concern, like, you know, we all do use roads. We all kind of depend on that piece of infrastructure. I started to like look at, okay, well, what could that look like if the government didn't provide roads? Because, of course, like, we don't know. If government's always been providing something, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if you're a kid and you're growing up at home and your parents are always feeding you, like, you don't think about how are you going to get food when your parents stop feeding you. But then one day, you know, you get old enough, you have to leave the nest, and you figure it out. But for roads, it's kind of like, I don't know, when I moved out of the house the first time, I was excited. I was like, yeah, I'm going to get a job. I'm going to go pay my rent and buy my own food and cook whatever I want. And, you know, that was the thing. But it's like with roads, it's like, no, I'm safe here at home with my parents providing my roads for me. I don't know. What kind of insights do you have on roads?
You know, there's a few different ways to approach that question of roads. I think one of the ways that you would first address it is to imagine some other sort of industry that's currently provided privately, and, you know, play a little thought experiment and say, you know, imagine if the state provided this, how many generations, or maybe not even generations, would it take for us to forget that such a thing was possible without the state? You know, and that sort of thing happens a lot. Like, it's going to happen with healthcare, I'm sure, real soon. We'll forget that one day all of this used to be completely privatized. But the other major argument for that is, we know that there's private roads out there. We know that they exist. It's a thing. There's private roads. There's private construction companies that took private capital and built a road, and now you pay to use it. And they're usually a lot better. I cite in the article that there's a movement now that the governments are going to a user pay model for their infrastructure, for their roads and stuff like that, because they're learning that it's actually more efficient to have toll roads than to have taxes collected and then contracted out to be built. They're realizing that that sort of thing, the pricing system, happens to work a little bit better than taxation. And, you know, that in combination with the fact that we already have private roads, it's a pretty strong argument for like, okay, well, let's just expand that. Let's just privatize it, you know, and what's the worst that happens? It doesn't work, but I don't think that's what we would find at all. And then, you know, lastly, I touch on the article that we have to consider a future in which we're no longer using roads. You know, what is going to be your justification for the state once we're no longer really using roads anymore? I mean, that's, I'm sure, in the near future, we just won't be using them anymore. The technology is exceeding to such a degree that we really won't have use for roads like we used to. And, you know, what then? What argument do they present then? The roads will be a nonsense question. So it's there's a lot of different ways to address that argument.
Right. Yeah. I it's you know, like you say, with different businesses, that's interesting too, because it's you know, let's say the phone company, right? They used to have wires going all throughout the city, and that was kind of a monopoly in a way. But that was always protected by government, right? Through regulation, who's allowed to go put down new wires. But it's a system that's like, you know, it's a big network that's almost like roads, and a private company put that all down. And when those roads couldn't handle the capacity of the number of calls going through it, they went and they put down bigger cables, and other companies started putting down cables as well to compete with them. And you know, it's not, you know, it's completely different than a road, but it's a huge network. It's a huge piece of infrastructure that was put there without the help of government, if anything, in spite of government. And yeah. And then, you know, like you said, if the government were to take that over, you're absolutely right. There would be, you know, a couple generations, nobody would know where that comes from. In fact, like, I mean, we're already kind of at that point with so many other things, not necessarily with government, but like with food. Like, where does our food come from? Like, most people just think it comes from the grocery store or from a restaurant. And, you know, they have no concept of what a farm looks like or what it takes to grow food on their own. And if that system were to ever collapse, they'd be totally screwed, which is a pretty dangerous thought. And that kind of, I think, harbors a fear that, you know, that's why we need government, to make sure that this whole food infrastructure, now that of course depends on roads to deliver all this food, we need more government to make sure that doesn't collapse.
I mean, how does a farmer invest $500,000 into a combine, millions of dollars more into acres of land, and then you buy his product for a couple bucks at the supermarket? You know, nobody, it's hard to imagine how that's possible, yet there it is. It works. You know, right. You, for something that's a trivial cost to you, it somehow profits from this farmer profits, even though he places millions of dollars into his investments into providing you with this product, and you pay just this trivial sum for it. The system works. And if there's anything that we can say is true, it's that capitalism works. There's just too much evidence out there to even be denied anymore. I mean, they always say that the anarchists or the libertarians place too much faith in the free market, but it's like, it's not blind faith. It's well supported. You know, right. When we say we have faith in the market to provide these services like roads and defense and security in the future, it's not some blind faith in the market. It's based on just hundreds of years of empirical data. You know, it's a solid argument.
Right. Yeah, like the farmer doesn't know, like, you know, the farmer doesn't have his ledger. Okay, I'm going to send exactly 57 cucumbers to this city. Like, you know, he grows as many as he can. He takes them to a market. Someone buys a couple truckloads of them. That, you know, you have these huge networks of stores that they're bringing them into, you know, into local regions and then distributing them to their stores from there. It's really interesting how that all works. And it's like, to the farmer, all he cares about is he's got one point of sale, which is the person who's buying it from him, the distributor. And he just grows as much as he can and gives it to them. And they don't worry about it either. They deal with, you know, the next step down. And it's ultimately you going to the grocery store, which is between you and the grocery store, determining, you know, how much are they going to order, or, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that, of course, fluctuates all the prices because, you know, the farmer doesn't care what it's going to look like, as you know, when it's that price on the shelf either. It's just all kind of it's so I heard this analogy. It's like, you know, your body has all of these white cells that, you know, when you get, like, you catch a cold, right? All your white cells go and they try and attack the cold. But you don't micromanage that, right? You don't, like, okay, I'm going to close my eyes and meditate and I'm going to control every single one of my little white cells to, like, run around and find the cold virus. It's, you know, you trust that your body is going to do that. And maybe you help it out by taking vitamins or, you know, do a flu shot, whatever you want to do. You help it out to encourage that along, but you don't micromanage it at all. You don't even make sure that each vitamin gets to each white cell. It's just you influence the market and let it do its thing. It's really fascinating how that works, but it's like, yeah, we all have to kind of trust in chaos almost. But it's real, also really interesting that, you know, that's what politicians are selling us, is the fear. Like, no. we can't trust chaos. We have to control every little thing. And I'm the guy to do it. And yeah, it's fear to control.
Is how they do it. Yeah. And the market, it's basic praxeology. You know, when the exchange is voluntary, it stands to reason that both parties mutually benefit. That's the nature of a voluntary exchange. That's free from force. So it, you know, you build up from that axiom, and of course the free market is superior to any sort of course of action. That's an all or nothing sort of game. So it's really tough to hear those arguments against the market when it's given us so much. You know, it's, you have to really deconstruct that argument in order to try to get through to them. But well, you do the best you can, you know, and right. I think in my book, I try to bring it there in the simplest way possible, and hopefully it makes a difference.
So what's something else from the book? What other kind of arguments do you have in there?
Well, I think I have a few moral arguments in the end of the book. You know, most of my arguments in the core of the book are more kind of the argument from effect, the pragmatic arguments of how would we do this or that, and they're evidence-based. But my moral arguments deal more about, you know, they're a little bit more philosophical. And I think those arguments are, the conclusions are the same as others in, you know, our philosophy would have come to. But I think the way I present the argument is mostly original to me. So, for instance, my will of the people argument, you know, I broke down one of the last elections between Trump and Hillary, and, you know, I basically demolished, based off the voter results, you know, I demolished this idea that the will of the people means anything at all, and things like that, coming up to reasoning up from first principles and really attacking these moral arguments that are usually given in support of the state. And I think those are more original to me. So I really like that aspect of the book too.
Cool. Yeah. There's, I'm flipping through it right now. I'm trying to find, there was something I remember reading that was, I'm not sure how to explain this. I took this weird class in, like, middle school, and it was in place of a math class, but it was a logic class, and it was almost like a machine logic, right? So it kind of I think it was kind of like a preface into, like, maybe computer programming or something. But they have, like, these equations that are, you know, if one thing, then something else. And it's they would use, like, there's, like, an implies symbol, right? And so if you were to say, you know, if P implies Q, then Q does not necessarily imply P, or that it's, or actually, in fact, that it's, that, Oh, so let's say P implies Q, then if not Q, then not P, right? So if for example, if P is you build a house, then Q is you have a house. If you don't have a house, then obviously you didn't build a house. And there's, it's really interesting that there's, and it gets more complicated than that, right? In basic math terms, that's like learning 1 + 1. And they have multiplication and division and all kinds of crazy, crazy types of logical arguments. And I can't remember what it was about your book that made me think of this, but it's really a very concrete way to structure a logical argument, especially, and of course, it's always on the basis that the facts that you're putting into the machine are correct. But you can come up with all kinds of logical conclusions based on what you're putting into that, using these kind of equations. So I thought, I don't remember exactly what it was, but something like in the first couple chapters reminded me of that.
Yeah, and I'm surprised that they were teaching you logic in school. That was shocking to me. I think that more people should be instructed in logic, and we would be in a different place. But
It was weird because there was this it was this crazy teacher that we had, and he actually, I mean, I think he had to petition the school to like be able to teach it. It wasn't part of the curriculum, but he's funny because he retired at, you know, I don't know how old he was. He must have been 70 something, and he realized that if he retired and started taking his pension, he'd be getting paid more than the salary that he had because he'd been working for so many years. So he retired, and then he went back to the school and said, "I want to work for free." And the school said, "Well, we can't, because when the kids are in your class, then we don't get money from the district."
Oh, of course.
So, yeah. So they turned down a free teacher, which is insane, and like probably one of the best teachers at the school. But yeah,
public sector.
Yeah, right. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Like that's that is something that should be taught. It's more of like, you know, how to think, not what to think.
Exactly. Yep. And these, you know, I think I have in mind where you're looking. I can't recall the chapter where I mentioned, but what you're talking about, I remember something like that. And I said something to the effect, you know, when you start with these very basic, I think it was in the chapter on consent. And when you start at these very basic axioms and these very basic things that we generally accept, you know, the conclusions of them can be drastically different than what most people hold to be true. So, you know, it comes back to starting from first principles. It's like you and I both believe this thing, both accept that the violation of consent is unjust. We're both there, but somewhere along the lines, you're losing sight of that. And so that can change your entire outlook on life. And it's, yeah, that was on the chapter in consent that I made that point that you're bringing up, and it can have a really powerful effect on certain people who choose to listen.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. That's almost like, you know, when you go to, I'll use the example of like a sales pitch for like a timeshare, right? You're sitting there and, you know, they tell you how you start. Okay, so you pay this much to get started, you put this money down, and then by this time next year, you're going to have all these points, you're going to be renting it out, making profit, all this, you know, money's going to be deposited in your bank. But they, like, if you don't follow all the steps, and they skip a lot of steps in the middle, then you're going to be of the assumption, oh, so all I have to do is give you, like, you know, a couple $100 right now, and I'm in. And you totally miss the part about, you know, you're going to be spending thousands over the next couple of years. And yeah, there's a chance you could be making some money back on it, but that doesn't account for fluctuations in the market and everything else. And so now you're like in this position where you're totally screwed, because you are led to believe, and this is what the same thing politicians do. You're led to believe that you pay the tax and you vote for the person to get into office, and they're going to implement this program, and the program is just going to make your life perfect. And you have the beginning and you have the end, but you don't really understand the middle. And then when, you know, when you start on that journey and then somebody gets into office and they start, you know, in the middle and they don't even understand the middle, you never get to the end, or the end just comes out completely different, because, you know, I can give you a beginning and an end. That doesn't mean they're going to really connect. It's almost like the if you remember the underpants gnomes on South Park, where they're like, step one, we're gonna steal all the underwear. Step two was just a big question mark, and step three was profit. And everybody's like, well, what's step two? I don't know, but step one, we got to do step one for right now. So they were running around stealing underwear.
There was a first quote in my book that I quoted Plato, and he said something to that effect. You know, when you accept the conclusions when your premises aren't known, you might have a coherent idea in your head, but the truth is beyond you because you're operating on unknown premises. You know, sure, it makes sense when the politician says, you know, we need to give you health care because health care is too expensive. It's like, okay, well, yeah, that makes sense. But did you check your premises? You know, why is healthcare expensive? What happens when, you know, taxation is added to it to supply you with healthcare and subsidize the already expensive industry? You know, nobody checks their premises. That's exactly, you know, that's a quote from Ayn Rand, you know, check your premises. And that's what happens. It makes sense when you don't check your premises. The whole rhetoric that the politicians say that they'll bring you this and this will help. Well, yeah, that makes sense if your premises are true. And, you know, more often than not, they're not true. So,
right. I wonder if there's any, I mean, yeah, cause it's like the plan has to make sense too, right? I guess, you know, if you got a blueprint for a house and there's no structure in the walls, then when you try to build it, it's just going to fall on top of itself. So, you know, yeah, you're going to have a house, but it's just going to be a roof on the ground. And I wonder if there's, you know, if there's some inclination from people to buy that from politicians to say, well, you know, this guy says he's going to build me a perfect house for free, that I'm, you know, he's going to make my life better. But as long as it's not a cost to me, it's a cost to, you know, some billionaire, some people who make more than me. It's not going to be a cost to me. And if it fails, well, I didn't lose anything. That's on the politician. At least he tried.
Right. And there's definitely some times when certain people can benefit from the state without any cost to them. But of course, when you say you're going to take it from the billionaires, you know, all the rich and the wealthy corporations, it's like, yeah, that'll work probably in the short run. But then you got to ask yourself, what happens? What happens when you start taking from the people who are providing you with everything that you use on a daily basis? What happens when you start attacking and robbing them? Where are they going to go? What are they going to do? What's going to happen to their business? What's going to happen to their prices? And so, you know, that logic makes sense. You know, let's tax the rich and give it to the poor. The poor are happy, and the rich, well, they'll still have money, so no big deal. But it's like, okay, but there are consequences to actions, and you're not looking at them. And that's just the pragmatic look at it. You're not even considering, you know, the moral aspect to it. So it's, yeah, check your premises, because more often than not, you're going to be wrong. So,
right. What do you think about, I kind of see, you know, politicians like to pick on people who are kind of struggling in life, right? Like, it's easy to sell them, right? We can give you, you know, whatever problem you're facing in life, we can solve it with a new government program. What I've found is, or, you know, what I'm trying to do with my campaign anyway, is to reach out to those people to kind of get their attention off of, you know, whatever Bernie Sanders is giving them for free, to kind of get them to recognize that the reason that they're in that position, the reason that they're struggling in the first place, is because of government. Like, there's, you know, everybody's worried about what happens when automation replaces our jobs. We need a higher minimum wage because I can't pay my rent on what I'm earning. But nobody really stops to think like, well, wait, why do we even have jobs in the first place? Like, that was never a thing until, you know, the last couple hundred years. And before that, it was just slavery. And like before that, it was just like people, you know, just living free, unless there were, you know, kings and tyrants telling them, you know, well, we'll let you live kind of free as long as you give me all the crops that come off your land. But, you know, that was kind of that was a really popular way of living where people could just kind of, you know, do their own thing. You look at like all the greatest inventors who, you know, they discover electricity and bifocals and chemistry and astronomy and all this other thing. And how did they come up with all this? Like, it wasn't like they were, you know, a government funded program. A lot of them kind of did that in their spare time because everybody had so much spare time because we didn't have to work 40-hour jobs, you know, just to keep a roof over our head. And somehow we've turned into that. And I blame government for that. Of course, I blame government for everything. But what's your thought on that?
Yeah, I mean, again, you have this simple idea of having the government provide you with something that you need because you work too much and you still don't have enough money. And but there's so many other ways that you could attack that line of reasoning, like you were saying, everything that you were saying. And then, you know, first I would ask if I were to address that same question, it's like, well, you want the government to give you everything you need. Well, how has it worked so far? You know, has it worked? Are there solutions effective at all? And of course, the answer to that question is no.
You have the statists who will say, well, no, but it's only because the other party's been in charge and they haven't let my politician give me what he wants to give me.
Right. It's it's hard to talk to those people at all to begin with. I don't know if I would even have a conversation with them for starters, but if they're receptive to evidence, I would say, you know, you could point to the evidence and say, well, look, these, you know, welfare programs have been around for, what, 50, 60 years, something like that. And absolutely no change in really the standard of living for the poor. I mean, well, the standard of living has increased, actually. But
right.
As far as have these programs been effective in their stated cause, and it's, well, no, they're only subsidizing poor. They're incentivizing poor. And today's poor, well, they're not really poor, you know, in the rest of the world looks at them and it's like they are, what is it? You know, they're the 1%, right? Compared to the rest of the world, it's
right.
Like our poor really aren't poor.
Right. They all
in
have
that
cell
sense.
Phones and internet,
cell phones,
and cable
TVs,
and
cars, homes, air conditioning. You know, they have all right. of these things. They live better lives than the greatest of kings, you know, not so long ago. And so you look at all that, and then again, you know, well, they work too much. Well, how much of that is the government confiscating and how much of that is being stolen from you for inflation and how many things do you purchase, you know, add up all of the tax in the things that you purchase. And, you know, I wrote an article not too long ago about just thinking about taxes in your everyday purchases. Most people will purchase something like a car and think, well, yeah, there's sales tax. It's like, well, no, there's the sales tax, but then you got to think about, well, what about the taxation in every step of the manufacture and production of that vehicle? You know, the steel was taxed, the rubber was taxed, the plastic for the interior was taxed, the glass was taxed, the paint is taxed, all of the wiring, you know, the gold and the wiring, that's all taxed. And those products all came from other factories that were taxed and regulated and, you know, in order to mine up those, you know, the compound taxation, people don't really understand just how much that affects these things that we purchase every day. And so if you really cared for the poor and you wanted them to have more money, really, I can't think of a more simple solution than to create at least a tax shelter. Maybe you don't want to get rid of taxes altogether, but okay, let's create a tax shelter over the essentials of life and over the poor's income and all of that sort of thing. And people generally aren't receptive to the most common sense arguments. You know, who's taking their money? Well, let's stop taking their money first and then see what happens. And yeah, there's those surface arguments that you usually get. You know, you can go so much right. deeper, but fortunately people just don't have the attention span to listen to them all. But like right. I said, again, in my, I hope to address those things as quickly as possible so that they're more receptive.
Right. Yeah. It's definitely interesting, right? Like I don't know if you're into sports, but I'm totally not. But it just fascinates me how it's the bread and circuses argument, right? Like it fascinates yeah. me how like everybody can memorize the entire history of like a team and, you know, the best hitter, the best pitcher, like all this other stuff, all the stats, everything else. But then when it comes to, you know, if baseball or football or anything went away tomorrow, nobody's life would be dramatically changed. But when it comes to, you know, government, which like affects every single person every day, it's like a lot of people just don't have the time for it. And it's,
yeah, they don't even see that it affects them is the worst part. They don't care for politics or for government, because what are they, you know, I don't care. They don't do anything to me. It's, well, they do more than you realize. So,
right. Let's see. What other kind of good points do you have in this book?
Well, let's see. I mean, the one at the beginning, I really try to give people an understanding of what the state is, how it came about, what it's really, what the structure of it is. Mm-hmm. And in there, I think there's a lot of things that might be enlightening to some people that that's never even considered the question of, okay, what is the state? You know, what is it? Most people don't really ask themselves that question before deciding whether or not they're going to support this institution or not. And kind of showing how the state is very purely just born in blood and violence and extortion, that's something that's kind of foreign to most people. They've never actually considered that. And when you do consider it, when you look at the history of governments and how they came to be, it's an inescapable fact. It's that they were born in violence, and that is what they are. They are the use of violence. And that's, to open up the book like that, I think it was really important so that people could really understand, you know, now they have to justify that. They have to justify this institution of violence, because that has to be the first realization you come to, is what it is. You have to agree to terms, right? Whenever you're having any sort of logical discourse or debate, what you'll usually see is that there's an agreement to terms, because people define things different ways. They see things right in different perspectives. So you have to come, whenever you're arguing with a person, you have to at least agree to terms, because if you're not agreeing to terms, you're talking about two separate things and you'll never see eye to eye. So the very first thing you have to do is agree to terms. And when I lay out that argument of what the state actually is, it's a very important part of the book, because you have to understand, first and foremost, the state is an institution of violence and extortion. And then afterwards, you have to make a choice whether you're going to abandon your support for it based on that fact, or if you're going to continue to support it, what are your justifications for doing so? And then throughout the rest of the book, I examine those justifications and see if they're, you know, if they're worthy.
Right. Yeah, I think that's really important for two reasons. One is, you know, a lot of people, when they're faced with that, you know, even for me, you know, fighting taxes since, you know, trying to start my first business and you know, having to file taxes and having to send, like, you know, a big check to the IRS and all that stuff. It seemed to me, and, you know, especially with the people around me supporting that, telling me, well, yeah, that's just what you got to do. That's just the way the world works. And it kind of, hearing that there was so much support for that around me, and knowing that the government, like, I kind of already knew that the government was a violent institution, but I didn't, like, I had the impression that it was only violent against criminals, right? But at the same time, it was like, but I don't like this tax system. And I felt like if I were to speak out against it, then I would somehow be at the other end of that gun. And it kind of, so even though I had the thought that it was only violent against bad people, it was like that fear still kind of hung over me, because I didn't want to be on their bad side, because then that violence might be used against me. And I think that's maybe a fear that keeps a lot of people from wanting to, you know, to even think or even say something. You know, they're afraid of the thought police coming by and telling, oh, yeah, no, you can't think that. But
it's a, yeah, it's a very real thing. I lost a job because of it. I was an active critic against the local police department here, and it's a relatively small community here. And I was an active, you know, I'd go on their Facebook posts every time they make a, you know, marijuana bust, and I would have something to say about it. Well, I work security at a hospital, and next thing you know, the deputy chief of police showed up and had a little secret meeting with the upper management of the hospital, and that day they asked me to leave, not come back.
Wow.
So it's a very real thing. You will make enemies when you stand up to these powerful institutions, and furthermore, when everybody seems to support these institutions, you're going to make a lot of enemies. So you really, if you're going to go into a life of activism, you have to be prepared for that.
Right. Absolutely.
The thought police, they're already here. You know, we have thought police. So it's a very real thing.
I think also there's, you know, when people start asking the questions, okay, well, without government, how are we going to catch murderers? How are we going to maintain order and all this other stuff? I think maybe there's two types of people where, you know, so when you present this idea that, hey, government is violent and we should figure out how to get rid of it, some people are going to question that because they're trying to kind of like, you know, they're trying to set you up so that you get to the point where you can't answer questions so they can see, haha, it would never work. But then I think there are some other people who are interested in the idea. And the way that they're asking those questions is almost kind of a way of, okay, well, that's interesting, but is that possible? And without saying, yeah, that sounds like a great idea, because they're worried about the thought police, at least questioning so that they can hear more. So I think that's something that used to frustrate me in the beginning, was people would ask me these questions and I would just be like, don't you get it? We just need to get rid of the government. And it would be so frustrating to have to answer these questions. But at the same time, it's kind of like, no, this is actually a good thing. This is the conversation that leads them down that path of asking these questions, where, you know, I had to ask a lot of these questions to myself because I didn't have anybody to ask, and I had to kind of figure them out on my own. I don't know if your experience was the same, but if you can be that person to answer those questions for somebody who's asking them, that's actually tremendous in helping them come to that same conclusion that the government is violent and we need to find an alternative way to have our society.
Yeah. And when you have those conversations and they're successful, there's, you know, it really means something. It's a powerful moment to know that you have persuaded somebody using reason and evidence and, you know, moral arguments, and now they have completely changed their lives and they no longer support this Leviathan that's controlling all of our lives. It's like, this is how we do change. You know, I'm not the type of anarchist or libertarian that would advocate for violent revolution and, you know, killing cops, all of that stuff. I don't advocate that at all, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's not the solution. That's not going to get us anywhere.
Right.
We need an evolution of mentality here. We need to have these discussions with people and change minds in that way. That's the use of reason over force, and that's what we stand for. And those conversations are really, it's the most important conversation of the century. I think we're at a tipping point now where we can either have this, you know, second era of enlightenment and go the right direction, or we're going to slip into this, you know, dystopian, totalitarian, socialist nightmare. And I think we're at that point where we got to do it one way or the other. And I think the internet is very responsible for that. We can communicate these messages in mass, whereas we couldn't do that before. And now we're having these conversations on this platform, and it's either going to go one way or the other. I see it now. And I think those, like you said, those conversations are important. And I think they're actually, you know, the most important.
Right. Well, we'll see what happens when we hit the point of no return.
Right.
So right now, your book's available on Amazon for order. Where can someone go to find that? I think I have the link for your Facebook page in this live stream. If somebody's interested in the book, where can they get it?
Yep. So first, you can go straight to Amazon and do a search for The Case Against the State. It'll be the first one that pops up. The book is being delivered right now through print on demand, so that's why it's being sold exclusively, so I don't have to pay the upfront cost of printing. So Amazon's where you find it, and then you'll find a link on my personal page in the bio there, and then you'll also, if you go to the Case Against the State Facebook page, there'll be a link as well directly to the Amazon purchase page.
Cool, awesome. All right, well, is there anything else you want to plug before we get on our way?
You know, I'm good. I just want to say thanks for having me on, and I appreciate what you do and the conversations you have.
Absolutely. And what is taxation?
It's definitely theft.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on. Thank you, everybody, for watching. Make sure to check out the book. It is really awesome. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
Rhodes.
You boys!